Welcome to Authorization in Software, the podcast that explores everything you need to know about authorization. I'm your host, Damian Schenkelman, and in each episode, we'll dive deep into authorization with industry experts as they share their experiences and insights with you. If you're a software developer or just someone that's interested in the world of authorization in software in general, you are in the right place. Let's get started. My name is Damian Schenkelman, and today I'm chatting about how Box approaches authorization with John Halfacre, distinguished engineer at Box. Hey, John, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Damian.
It's my pleasure. Could you maybe give our listeners a brief overview of your background and what you're doing at Box nowadays?
Yeah, for sure. So I started my last job was at a faceted search company called Endeca in Boston. We powered sites like Newegg and things like that. Like whenever you like search for a part or a video card, and then there's like the price range and things down the side, we enabled a lot of that. We did a lot of analytics apps and eventually were acquired by Oracle. I then moved over to Box a decade ago. And sort of the first team I joined there was the team that was launching our public APIs for consumption by platform partners and third-party applications. And one of my first big efforts there was on our metadata platform. So I launched our metadata facility, which lets customers define types, templates, whatever you want to call them. Like say they want to store a contract with us. And so they could say the amount, the counterparty name, the expiration date, things like that. And we use that as they fill out values, you can use that for, again, faceted search, but also workflow. It kind of goes in a lot of different places. And we do this a little bit right now, but hopefully over time, it also helps drive authorization decisions. So, and then during building that, so Box is a kind of pre-AWS company. So we had our own data centers, and I saw how challenging it was to get, because we were evolving from a monolithic architecture towards a more service-based one. And I saw how hard it was to get a new service launched at Box. So I moved over to work on one of our internal platforms built on Kubernetes. We're super early adopters of Kubernetes. Interesting story, Box built the initial version of kubectl, which people use a lot today.
I did not know that. That's an interesting fact.
Yeah, our co-founder, one of our co-founders actually ended up building that. We were just super bleeding edge. Deployments didn't exist. We were manually managing replica sets, super early on the kube bandwagon, and went through all the different growing pains. But it was a great opportunity to interact with Joe Beta, Craig McLucky, Brian Grant, Tim Hawken, all those people that started that project, and work with them on how to use it and round out the ecosystem. We built a lot of early components there. It was definitely challenging. I probably, from a business standpoint, probably hopping on the bandwagon a little bit later might have been a better move, but super fun as an engineer to work on a project that early in its lifespan. And then after, that got stable, fairly well adopted internally, I moved back to working with our core team, which is, if you think about the backend / platform for everything you think about when you think about Box, files, folders, users, groups, enterprises, all the just sort of core high-scaled objects that you think about, that's where I'm working now, just across a very, very, very wide variety of efforts there, including still interfacing with our internal platform teams as we do big migrations as representation from the core team. So I think that covers all of it. Hopefully your listeners aren't asleep yet, but
it's interesting because you've been through a few different areas of a very large product and platform, right? In my case, I've done some similar things here at Otsido and Okta, and that gives kind of like a unique perspective whenever you're building authorization capabilities or any kind of like platform capability in general. So I think that perspective will be very interesting for anyone listening to the episode, because we'll be able to mix general kind of like product and technology perspective with kind of like a more security and authorization perspective.
Totally. Yeah, it's Box. I like to say about Box. So yeah, I've been here a decade, but I've had like three very different jobs over that time period. And Box has like big company problems, but sort of small company infrastructure. And so anytime we go to build something new or develop something new, we're always looking at it from a very basic level all the way down to the platform level to think about how we can best serve both our internal and external customers. So yeah, it's a fun place to work. I'm sure you probably have a lot of similar experiences at Okta, just working on very high impact, basic stuff all the time.
Yeah. One of the great things I like to tell folks about my job is that we get to experiment and figure out kind of like, in our case, what the identity industry is going to look like maybe in the next 5 years, but we are the ones shaping it, considering kind of the impact that we can have.
Yeah, it's very fun as an engineer.
Yeah, definitely. So as always, I like to start with the why, right? And this is why I was saying that I think your context, not just working on authorization, but in general across the Box product and the Box platform, will be useful. Why is authorization important at Box, and what happens if authorization is not working properly?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of layers to this answer, and we can talk through both. But the high level is Box. You have to think about it for a minute, but Box is secretly a security company. So, you know, storing files, managing the metadata, managing all that, like all the facilities to extract value out of files, certainly isn't easy. But when customers come to us and they buy us, it's, you know, the big blocker for most people moving from like their on-premise SANs or shared res is the security risk, right? Like you're putting your files on the internet, you don't want it to get out there, you don't want the various governments or state actors to get access to them. So, you know, the kind of key facility that we sell to our customers and probably the biggest risk to our business is having like a big security incident in terms of losing customer trust. So we spend an enormous amount of time as a company thinking through all the different security aspects. So our security organization tends to break down on two lines. Like there's the application security and then there's like the infrastructure security. And our application security team's just very focused on like, how do we ensure that the application that we have is not, you know, like somebody doesn't add a new line of code and make files accessible to anyone that has access to the system or, you know, various application concerns. How do we build the product securely, like running pen tests? We work with HackerOne a lot, which has been a really fruitful relationship in terms of getting early pen test results. But also there's like the other whole other side to that, which is we're basically a file storage, file productivity platform. How do we give tools to enterprises to help help their users not expose things, right? Like, there's always some level of sharing that you want to do with a document, either internally or externally, and allowing those, your internal users, to do that safely and securely is a big deal. So we all, you know, all the way down from like shared individual shared link expiration and things like that and passwords, all the way up to more advanced stuff like classification policies. We just launched information barriers functionality that helps keep different parts of the enterprise from seeing each other's content. Email uploads, secure file request features, things like that. So yeah, it's security is a very big deal to us and our customers. So, and all of those are different types of authorization decisions. And then like the more low level infrastructure oriented authorization decisions are, I'm sure your customers are fairly aware of all these issues of making sure that, you know, your IAM's roles are locked down, don't have least privilege access to various resources, ensuring that an attacker that somehow manages to get access to one node can't pivot and start moving laterally through the infrastructure is another place where we spend a lot of time. And we use things like micro segmentation using Calico. I know we've got some OPA policies down at the infra layer validating that changes, that the person making a change should be able to make that change. Yeah, so just layers and layers of authorization decisions floating around here.
Yeah, I was going to say, right, like you folks store a bunch of sensitive data on behalf of customers, and like everything else, like security is about layers and layers and different kind of like ways of protecting things. One thing that you mentioned was that, again, like there are a lot of things that you can do, right? You need to authorize users, you need authorization at the infra level. There are multiple ways in which you can file share. You can file share to a user, you can file share with like temporary time limits, you can upload like in an email, things like that. And then there's also kind of like, you mentioned the notion of at the beginning of having an API and working with partners, which means there's also kind of like app permissions. So
yeah,
a lot of things. How, like at a high level, and we'll dig deeper across kind of like the show, but like how does Box handle authorization? Can you maybe give us an overview of that?
Yeah, so we have lots, and this is something that's a little bit in flux, but we, like, obviously depending on the thing that you're asking about, there's lots of opportunities for authorization checks. But the bulk, I'm going to talk specifically here about the application's authorization decision. So like if I fire up my web browser and I browse to a folder and it shows all the items there and then I upload a file, those are all, there's all individual authorization checks being done at each step in that UI. Can I access, can I view the folder? Can I view the folder's children? Can I view that file? And can I upload a file into that folder? Are all different authorization checks that we need to do. And given the nature, given our nature as kind of a web application, we tend to, and given the complexity of the object model and authorization scheme, we repeat the same checks over and over again on each request. So, so, and even if I'm like viewing, seeing if I can see a user, we have to see, can you have access to that user? Like, can you see that user through your collaboration graph? Are you in the same enterprise? Can I see a comment, etc.? And so the way this is orchestrated, and so this is something that's changing as we migrate, as we break down our monolith, but I'm just going to talk specifically about our monolith for a moment. So we have effectively the old, so Box started out as a LAMP, classic LAMP stack way back in the day. And within there, you know, we have like a kind of active record model that was home built. And on each of those, at any kind of point in the code, you can say, does this context have the ability to see, does it have this permission, whatever the verb is, on this object? And there's some that are built deep down into the data layer. So like anytime you try to fetch a file's metadata, it's system metadata, like name or the size, that kind of like core object information, we check if you have view access. And there's a few other places like that. And within that, that kicks off that, like, do I have view access? Kicks off a call to our permissions policies, which are just more PHP code that basically break down into two flows, like a grant phase and a revoke phase. And at the end, we check, hey, did you get granted view, and is it still there? And if yes, then we, you know, return true and we return the object. And those policies are just like, it's probably the single most complex thing within the box system. It accesses the number of tables, very performance sensitive. It checks like, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask a bit about that, but again, you have kind of like these two ways of evaluating access for the positive and the negative. But since you can do it from anywhere on the code, and a lot of these things require state, from both a code review perspective, performance perspective, security perspective, this might be a bit tough to do, right? Like knowing when you should call it and having to optimize things so that like you minimize calls and so on.
Yeah, and this is one of those things that's specifically interesting as we move from the monolith to the microservices universe. Honestly, it's a tiny bit easier. There's a different set of challenges. In the monolith universe, you know, the request is largely happening within the monolith. And so we cache multiple calls or memoize multiple calls to the function. And so adding superfluous checks to the same object isn't at all a perfect, it basically short circuits out. In the services version of the world, but also on the monolith side, it can be somewhat, yeah, you want to do a balancing act between calling it too much, but also like the worst thing that can happen in box at some level is that you don't call it, right? From going back to the previous thing there. So that is one of the challenges with our monolith is you've got a bunch of library, it's a normal monolith, you got a bunch of library functions, some of which may call the permission check, some of which may not, and you need to ensure that the permission check is happening, but yeah, some of those library functions are used in permissions calculations themselves, and so you don't want to use, and some of them you don't want to be calling using permissions. So it gets to be a real struggle reasoning about where the permission checks are done, where it isn't. On the services side of the world, we've landed on like a really simple model. We have domain services, they have endpoints, and effectively every one of those endpoints has a permissions policy associated with it. So there's no question there about like where it's applied, when it's applied. It's applied very rigorously versus with the monolith, there's a lot of weight put on the testing to ensure that we're doing, I mean, obviously we need to do testing in both cases, but it's more error prone, and so you have to like really back yourself up with negative tests to ensure that all the permissions policies you expect are being enforced on an endpoint.
It's very interesting that It's pretty interesting that Box is, I'm checking things now, like 18 years old, right? Like started in 2005. And only now you're starting to kind of like go on the one hand towards microservices, and there's that whole industry debate always going on about like what's the right time, it's not the right time, but also starting to extract policies away from code and into kind of like more policy logic.
Yeah, I'll dive back into what we kind of do on some of the policies in a second, but just to answer that, we've been pulling services out. Like, we're kind of taking like the strangler pattern / like peeling an onion with our service-based approach. Even when I started, we had some initial very infra-centric services that were already being pulled out. And so at the places where it was easy to extract into services, we did. So like a lot of the unstructured data handling is already pulled out. A lot of our user extensible metadata is pulled out. A lot of the clients have had a bunch of their logic pulled out. So it's just kind of like we're pulling off the top and bottom of this monolith slowly but surely. And what's left in the middle, which is what we've been tackling for a year-ish, but it's very complicated and sensitive, so it takes longer, are the kind of core business logic. And so, yeah, it's just kind of a long-running process here. Box has a lot of stuff to do, so we go in and out of dedicating more or less resources to an effort like this. But yeah, to dive back to just for a second to the permissions policies themselves. So within any, like taking a file, for example, in the grant flow, we check, hey, is there a shared link in the request context? We call them collaborations, but you can think about it like an ACL. Are you collaborated on this file as a viewer, as an editor, as a whatever? Are you collaborated up the folder tree? Because we do this thing called waterfall permissions. And that's kind of the bulk of the grant phase. There's a few other steps in there that we could talk about, but they're less interesting. And then the revoke phase is like much more interesting. Like, is the thing deleted? Are there legal holds? Are you at quota? You can't upload more of this folder if you're at quota. And that gets a lot more complicated. So that's kind of the high level of authorization. I'm curious if there are places that you'd love to talk about more or things that were unclear. I'm used to doing this with a whiteboard. It's a little bit harder just gesturing with my hands.
Yeah, I get it. Maybe in a future season, we can do another episode with video podcasting, which is also becoming a fad. I'm curious to learn more about kind of like what you're evolving towards, right? Like, what technology is the service-oriented approach going to use for policies, how you picked it?
Yeah, so, and we've gone in and out on this decision, and we've like reconsidered it a few times. But for our services on our floor, we're using a Zacamal engine, open source Zacamal engine. I don't know how you actually pronounce that. X-A-C-L.
Yeah, X-A-C-M-L. Zacamal.
We're using Bolana, which we have a few developers that are ramped up on and are able to like make local patches to, in terms of like multi-attribute prefetch and things like that. So we have quite a few domain services on the floor that are using that for a lot of basic policy. And as of right now, we're in the middle of pulling the giant PHP permissions policy over to it. And that's got That's been an interesting discussion. I mean, Zacamal is obviously separating the permissions policy from the rest of the codes, obviously has some really nice benefits in terms of the one thing I previously mentioned is like it's very clear where it's enforced and when it's enforced. One of the challenges in that monolith land, like I mentioned, is you've got some things that need to run, like the permissions itself needs to run like in sort of a god mode, supervisor mode, in order to fetch the data, in order to see if you can even see the data. And so it creates a really clear boundary there where like the permissions policies have a lot of access internally. And, you know, we switch over to using, we call it a domain service token, but a version of our internal token that has basically indicates that you should, because we want to be able to reuse the data access logic from the service to fetch the files, but without inflicting the permissions calculation on, you know, without creating an infinite loop, basically. So yes, that's one super benefit, is it becomes very clear which, like, where the permissions are going to be enforced. They're going to be enforced on the endpoint, and the permissions policies themselves have broader access to the data than the normal natural callers to the endpoint. We looked at a few things. I mean, obviously, just like home build policy in Java was one thing. Zacamal was another thing. And we revisited as like OPA and Offset and all those things have come out, like whether those would be better choices. For me, having stared at this problem for a while, I would it feels like some machine learned approach here that like minimizes latency of the policy by using any features that you have available at request time, either the enterprise ID, user ID, certain request features, being able to find like a fast path through that to the grant would be a wonderful thing. We looked at OPA, and I was super excited about OPA for a while. It ended up, and it felt like, I haven't looked recently at OPA, so I apologize if I'm misstating any of the changes in direction they made, but they seemed like they were really heavily focused on infra security at that moment, really focused on like low data scale, like almost like IP tables level, like sub millisecond response times. And we have a lot more complicated policy issues here where, you know, we touch 60 plus tables. It's a large amount. You couldn't fit it into like kind of the static small database. They have like very large data sets, including the files folders, their collaboration relationships and things like that. And so it wasn't quite a fit. And I felt like we'd kind of be a use case that they would have liked, but been kind of way outside the where they were getting a lot of success and traction at that time. But yeah, there have been concerns about, you know, we were handwriting Zacamal for a while, which is obviously no developer enjoys that. So we actually have a bunch of libraries written in Java that effectively they generate Zacamal out the other side. So it's closer to like a Java-like experience with the IDE and things like that. But yeah, the big kind of question as we move the items permissions policies over are going to be, and as we move to microservices, right? Like the repeated checks thing starts to become more of a concern. We have a parallel project trying to enable GraphQL for some of our internal clients. And so like obviously naively that thing's going to try to you know, hit the same endpoint over and over sometimes. And so the permission recheck thing, figuring out how to do either a request level cache, which we had for a while, or some other type of caching in order to avoid the penalties there is going to become important. And then, yeah, just like ensuring that the underlying policy ideally is faster than the thing we currently have hand tuned in PHP. But at least at parity with the thing that we have is important. My secret hope as an architect here is, you know, the current policy is, you know, like I said, hand tuned, which is a polite way of saying very hard to change, right? Like some of these policies have order dependencies on the other parts and can't move them around without potentially creating a security issue. And so I would love to just get the policies into a place where they're naturally expressed the way you'd want to express them without thinking through the perf implications, and then allowing the underlying platform to intelligently make decisions about evaluation order and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I think there were a bunch of interesting nuggets there. I'm going to try to see if I got them. So
yeah.
So because you already have a set of policies, when you started looking for alternatives, on the one hand, you talked about Oban and that being kind of like more infrastructure-oriented, which I would tend to agree. I think Rigo as a language allows you to express everything, but like Oban and the toolset, it's more thought of for kind of like infrastructure when you think about like how they handle things like cache and state in general. It seems to kind of like go down that line. But at the same time, you already have policies, which means that you need to keep compatibility with that. And maybe you were used to expressing things in a certain way, which you probably want to maintain for security reasons, for like simplicity reasons, and so on. So again, XAML at least made the cut, and then you were like, okay, we're going to go with this implementation, which is banana. And then from that point on, it's about, okay, how do we improve things? So again, you got the, it's kind of like higher level, maybe DSL library in Java, so that you don't have to write the XAML code. You mentioned also that you're making changes internally to how the library works, which might be, again, you're making improvements to the caching logic and so on. So you kind of like have a small fork of Balana that you're kind of like tuning for Box, and that's kind of like what you ended up doing as part of that migration.
Yep, that sounds right. And we're always open. I think we're always open if like something revolutionary shows up. We're always open to considering other options here.
Yeah, the authorization space is kind of like fairly effervescent right now. And new things are coming up every day. Like I know, for example, AWS recently released open source, at least their policy language, which is kind of like yet another thing and has a few interesting benefits from like a static analysis perspective. We did an episode on that. There's a bunch of new SaaS companies kind of like looking at the space, open source projects. So yeah, I imagine over the next few years, you will be able to either replace or complement parts of what you're building with some of these solutions in the space.
That would be great. And as soon as we got out, like the key goal right here is getting out of sort of this thicket of permissions logic that we have. Like we have things that'll like short circuit for perf reasons that creates like the lack of commutivity of the policies. Or we'll have things that, you know, reject all permissions and things like that. So getting into XAML and like having the stuff naturally expressed puts us in a good place to experiment with other technologies more easily than kind of the free-for-all PHP code base we have.
Yeah, no, I get it. That makes sense. And I'd like to kind of like double-click on that, because you mentioned the notion of perfs. Earlier we were talking about like all the ways in which you can share documents with folks. So this is a problem that I've been thinking about for a few years now, which is when you get into granular document sharing, like anyone can view or not view, like specifically just one file. It's not the folder, it's not files, but it's on like any attribute or something. It's like they can either view or edit one file. When you get into performance, when you get into box scale, you are kind of like dealing with complex authorization requirements. So how does authorization work for file sharing? What happens when I share a file with another user and give them maybe read permissions or write permissions? How is that handled internally?
Yeah, so I guess this is a click down in terms of detail from the previous answers. But basically, like if you imagine going to our preview page to look at a file, you've been collaborated, to use our term, what happens is, you know, we go in, dive into that endpoint and eventually hit the permissions logic. And what'll happen is we pull back. I mean, the first thing we do is we try to access the file, which then triggers the permissions policy, the file metadata, which triggers the permissions policy, which will look through for that user what are all the collaboration that it's a part of.
So the file metadata includes the collaborations for the file, which would be the ways in which the user can interact with the file?
Yeah, not fully quite. So we have two tables under the covers. We have like a files table, a folders table, and a collabs table, collab being short for collaboration. In the collabs table, it's got the inviting user, the receiving user, as well as their role on that thing. And basically, because of the way things are done, like you'd think like, oh, just look at the collabs table for that user ID that's trying to access the file and the file ID. Unfortunately, we maintain things very normalized under the covers. So if you were collaborated at like a parent folder somewhere, we have to give you access based on the fact that you've got access at that parent folder. It's referred to as waterfall permissions. So basically what ends up happening is on each request where you're accessing a file or folder is we pull back all the things, all the routes or all the folders or all the files that you have access to. And then, you know, we quickly look through that list and see which, and we keep that capped. We recommend customers stay under like 10,000 of those. So it does require some thought on the customer side about how they want to store their permissions in a normalized way. But we scan that, look to make sure you have access to that file or any of its parents. And then if we do, there's actually, rarely do you just want, like we drive a lot of UI on the other side. Rarely do we just want to know, can you view the file, right? We want to know if you can delete it so we can know if we need to show the delete icon or not. We want to know if you can comment on it. We want to know a bunch of things about what you can do with this thing. So actually in the policies, we like compute en masse. They largely use the same data. We compute en masse what permissions do you have on this file? Can you comment on it? Can you delete it, etc.?
You don't have to ask the same question multiple times. It's not like you saying, hey, can the user view, then can the user edit, then can the user delete? It's more of a, hey, what, like from all of these, tell me which ones the user can do, something like that.
That's basically it. And then that function that I was talking about earlier, can you view it? All that thing does is looks to see if you have that permission amongst that array of permissions. This is something that, you know, we call it like bulk or batch permissions on the Bolana side, but that we have to do something slightly interesting here to fit into like the you know, you called GET, we can just evaluate the GET on the Bolana side, but we do want to be able to bulk calculate the permissions sometimes, because we do return to our clients, can it be deleted, can it be changed, etc. And so yeah,
that makes sense. And how do, so like, let's try to kind of like mix things up a bit, because you're saying, okay,
yeah,
you can have kind of like all of these sides, but you might have kind of like this cascading or waterfall permissions where you might have the ability to view a file, not because someone shared the file with you, but maybe they shared the file's parent or maybe even like grandparent folder. So this is kind of like everything is really a graph traversal problem if you look at it. But again, you might have multiple ways in which you reach the file. And then you also have groups, right? Like there's the notion of, hey, I can be part of a group, and maybe the group has the column. So it seems that there's a bunch of state that you have to kind of like put or have go through the policy, so that the policy can arrive at the right decision. I'm curious on like about a couple of things. One of those is like, again, you mentioned some recommendations to customers or like keeping things under like 10K objects for routes, but I'm not sure if I follow. So I'd be curious like how you limit that. And also I'd like to understand a bit more how you handle the groups with these kind of like traversal denomination like problem, right?
Yes, so you're correct. It is a lot of data, and groups is an interesting question in here. We make very extensive use of Memcache and Redis along the way through a lot of these calculations. So like that thing I mentioned around like what collabs am I on and like what groups am I in? Those pull extensively from cache. And that's probably one of our larger expenses. But so in terms of groups specifically, so groups is a fun one for us. In my like when I joined Box, there was no groups, and I'm like, this is quite crazy. Like, as an enterprise software company, that groups would be a key point of scale, like giving companies, your customers, some of which are very large, a scalable way to kind of manage access to content. We did add it a little way in. I wouldn't say it's necessarily 100% where I'd like to see it, but as of today, just in terms of that specific example we were talking about, we do pull all the groups that you're a member of, and we pull all the collabs for the groups that you're a member of, and we kind of mash that all in. And there's kind of a deep reason why, you like, if you stare at this use case and you think about it for a second, and you're like, this seems absolutely ludicrous to be like pulling all these things back each time, like pulling all the things you have access to when you know like the destination is this one file. Obviously like a database index would solve a lot of that for you pretty rapidly. The hidden thing in a lot of this is, so we have three or so and potentially more experiences. One obvious one being search, where there's an implicit filter. When I type like show me the documents containing must docs, there's an implicit filter there, right? Show me must docs in all the documents that I have access to. People don't think about that I have access to. Part of that
search is challenging.
Yeah, and as part of that, we basically, and we can talk about the low-level details of how we index that, and we also have to do that for like metadata query, which is another facility we support. But also, like, the main landing page at Box is this experience we call our All Files page, and it's basically kind of a virtual view of everything you own, everything you have access to, and a few other things. And so across these three different experiences, we basically end up having to look at everything you have, all the routes you have access to each time anyway. And so, you know, it ends up being, we end up just kind of relying on that facility for a lot of, well, basically all of our access control. Even though if you look at any particular use case, there'd probably be some way of optimizing the access there. And so, yeah, groups specifically, and like more interestingly, like your all enterprise group, which we've started supporting in certain limited cases. Yeah, we go through we expand the group, or we see which groups you're a member of. We start from you, walk out to groups you're a member of, and then figure out the collab objects on the other side of that and feed that into that giant machine. My ideal hoe over time here, like right now, we don't really index the groups that have access to a file in our search indexes and in our metadata query indexes. My hope over time is we would start doing that, and then just start passing in the group IDs there in order to reduce some of those, like those cardinality challenges. Like in terms of that 10K limit that I talked about before, basically any like core system problem at Box is like, there's just this hard trade-off between storing it normalized and having to deal with like an expansion and like bumping up against that 10K limit of folder IDs that we pass to our search index, or denormalizing it and making it fast, but then potentially bloating out the amount of data we have to store, or like just having like an operation that was fast before, like adding a collaborator, which was like O of one before, is now potentially an O of an operation where you have to like re-index everything.
Yeah, yeah. And then you get into, depending on how long that takes, if it's a few milliseconds, maybe it's fine. If it's going to be 3 minutes until the change is propagated, you might have issues from a security perspective. Like, different systems have different trade-offs there. But yeah, like,
and we're just constantly like, which one is it in this case? And thinking through all the implications of the normalization versus denormalization.
Yeah, I get it. Let's kind of like look at some kind of like of the numbers behind this. So first, like for each authorization decision, what data are you using? Like we talked about a lot of data. Can you give us an idea? And then what the performance of the authorization decisions typically is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, Box in general, and these numbers are going to be non-specific because I didn't run them by anyone, but we have hundreds of billions of documents that we're storing, like nearly an exabyte in scale of like the actual underlying content, hundreds of thousands of enterprise customers, and then, you know, like the customer size tends to follow like standard power law, where we have some that are like over 100,000 users, and then a lot of like really a lot smaller ones. I think our average customer size is like 30,000 users or something. And then just in terms of performance, it's highly variable. Like you can imagine based on how I described the authorization decisions, it can be very highly variable. Like for me, like when I go to my all files page, which is like my initial landing page, and I'm kind of at the harder end of the scale, it's to just like get the basic items, which is mostly just a permissions check on the items, because like fetching that read back is not that expensive. It's kind of close to a second, which compared to like, you know, some of those numbers you see from HOPA and Regal is probably two or three orders of magnitude higher. And then, but you know, you have, if you're a smaller customer or you don't have as complicated of a permission scheme, you're going to see lower numbers, but still probably in the hundreds of milliseconds range is probably our minimum there. But we do have, like, I mean, our CEO, ironically, you know, he's, you know, been there for, I don't know what you said, 18 years? He's been there for the 18 years.
18 years.
Has all that data accumulated. And so he, you know, his all files page experience, which he loves dearly, it can take him upwards of like 3 to 4 seconds to load, which is far from what we'd like it to be. And we obviously, we're working on a lot of projects to drive that number down. But at some level, some of this data that we have to process just takes time to access and run through. In terms of like overall throughput, we're dealing with like millions of requests per second.
That's a lot of requests, right? And so this is kind of like when you compare to some of the public metrics from our framework, saying this has been a system that's in prompt for a lot of years, exabytes of data. So it's not an apples to apples comparison. Let's just put it like that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, when you're serving an end user app, and we haven't really, I think we're going to maybe talk about integrations in a minute, but you know, we have a lot of things that integrate with us, least of which are like our desktop clients, which do basically try to maintain a replica of your view on the file system on the local system. And so, you know, we're pushing events out, they're making calls back, and so those drive a tremendous amount of load. We also have third party like products like CASB, virus scanners, things like that, that are just constantly hitting the APIs, ensuring that the data is protected. So yeah, we have a lot of things going on. And then I ran the numbers. We're doing like hundreds of thousands of permissions checks per second as part of that. Like anything that's accessing a file, there's some amount of a permissions check going on in there. So it's quite large scale, makes it fun. It makes some things like we use, you know, as we're extracting the core stuff, doing a lot of parity testing, it makes things like that feasible, like taking the old policy and the new policy and like running them through, comparing the results, ensuring they're the same. It makes those techniques more viable and more fruitful.
Yeah, then I can imagine, again, any change you make, you have to kind of like maintain the same kind of like backwards compatibility, let's say, from a result perspective, while at the same time making improvements. So it must be an exhaustive set of checks from multiple perspectives.
Yes.
You mentioned apps, which, yeah, like we discussed, we would touch on as part of the episode. And we mentioned them kind of like at the beginning, right? You started working on APIs for some of your kind of like partners. I know Box integrates with a lot of other apps, I would say typically kind of like B2E. How does authorization work with apps? How does a typical Box partner, a Box application that uses Box and depends on the Box API, work from an authorization perspective?
It's largely an added layer. So the API came later after all the permissions policies firmed up. And so the way this tends to work is if you're going to build a third-party integration or even a first-party integration, even our own teams use this, you provision, we call it a service, but application's a better name. You provision an application, you get your client ID, client secret, and from there, as part of that creation process, you specify what types of the underlying, like these apps, we do have a different mode where like the apps actually become a user within a particular enterprise, and those are more limited to the enterprises. But for your standard, like, kind of client use case, where it's doing something for a user, you specify what of that user's underlying permissions you need. Like, are you an admin app and you're just managing users for the enterprise, or are you like a content processing app and you need to be able to access their full tree, their full folder tree, or are you, you know, something that only needs access to a particular file or folder? And then we send you through, I mean, we obviously on the back end as part of that process, you can't just like publish that to like our application repository. It goes through a bunch of internal reviews. And then when we publish it, it's able to be used by people outside of your own kind of local enterprise. But basically what happens is it's a standard, we allow a different sets of the OAuth flows, but we use OAuth 2, and as part of that, we don't, I know there are other ways, like people use like scopes, and this might be the standard way, but when people use scopes, they'll like effectively pack that whole pre-computed permissions process into the scopes, and then it's just a matter of checking whether like the scope has access to that underlying file. Given how dynamic our permissions are, what we actually put in the scope are more of that client's permissions on the underlying user's permissions. So it's kind of an allow list on the underlying permissions. So it says this service, when it's accessing a file, can, you know, read or write all of their file or their whole folder tree. And so we basically check, hey, you accessed file 12345. We compute the permissions on it. Does this user even have access to file 12345? And then when it comes up through the API response handling, we check, does this application have the ability to read or write that user's files? And if yes, then we kind of we'll return the result or allow that API client to make that change. I mean, this is all done much more generically than how I'm talking about it, but that's the basic flow.
So I get what you mean. Like, we actually, the first episode we did of the podcast back in season one was with Vittorio Bertocci, who works with us, and we talked about how for scenarios like these where authorization is dynamic because like resources and permissions change and there's lots of them, scopes and embedding things in access tokens is not the way to go. So you kind of like in Box's case, you're saying, hey, we have scopes as a higher level notion, which might be, hey, we are going to be managing users, but you're not going to say which users, or I'm going to be reading or writing some folders. And then when you actually have to kind of like make the specific call, you just make sure that the access that the user consented to kind of like encompasses the specific thing. So if you're changing a folder's name, it would be, hey, can they write this folder's name? And did we actually grant access so that this token would be able to edit folder names or whatever that is?
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. And here, where is the authorization decision made for the kind of like API decisions?
Yeah, it's all done as part of that underlying permissions policy, I believe. Yeah, it's all done in that underlying permissions policy. And so it basically, as like the last phase, it computes all the permissions, like I said, that you have access to, like, can you view, can you comment, can you delete, can you edit? And then as like a last step, it will check like if it was a GET API, it's going to check, do you have view? And it'll take the application scope and use that as kind of an allow list on the underlying permissions. And if the scope was like, let's say, manage users, but they're trying to access a file via that app, it won't have view on that underlying file, even if the user has access, because you didn't grant that access to that application. And it's all just kind of all happening in the same place.
Okay, that makes sense. So you essentially you reduce the kind of like the pre-computed set of callouts, as we're calling them, that the user has on the file, and then saying, okay, this API call actually requires this callout. So going back to, hey, is the scope the correct one, and does the user have the callout? Makes sense.
Yeah, it's just sort of two phases. We compute the user's natural permission on the object, and then we basically filter out anything the user didn't, any access the user didn't grant to the application as part of the OAuth2 flow. Because as part of the OAuth2 flow, right, we send the user to a screen that says, are you okay allowing this application to read or write your files or manage your users? And so there's part of that whole flow that we have to maintain.
Yeah, the OAuth consent.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, but John, it's amazing, man. We did a very deep dive on Box, which is both a complex and a large system. And I'm sure the listeners will really appreciate in learning how kind of like a large, battle-tested, long-lived production SaaS deals with authorization. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, damn it. Thanks for having me. And if there are any listeners out there that are working on authorization systems that are interested in more detail, we're always open to conversation with open source developers or companies about what they're building.
Excellent. Thanks for the ask. And again, as John was saying, you should reach out to him if you're building something that might be useful for Box. That's it for today's episode of Authorization in Software. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us. If you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And if you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, feel free to reach out to us on social media. We love hearing from our listeners. Keep building secure software, and we'll catch you on the next episode of Authorization in Software.